Questions? Any thoughts?
On all the stuff that we've been doing.
All right, so let me recap a little bit some of the ideas from last time, and maybe put a different twist on some of it. So string theory came about as almost as a game. There are theoretical problems that you run into when you allow point-like interactions. And so some people thought, well, perhaps if instead of having point-like particles as the most fundamental thing that we can have, maybe we could imagine having extended objects, sort of one-dimensional type objects like strings. And it's very well known in classical physics, and we did it in class, where if you allow a wave to travel on the string and you fix the endpoints, it will interfere with the reflected wave, and there are only very particular states that exist, and those have quantized energies. And you could imagine then if you say that the building blocks in the universe are vibrating strings, that you can try to solve the solution. You could have the strings be open-ended. You could have them basically go in a circle. And in principle, you can solve the solutions for relativistic speed vibrations on the thing going around. So relativistic meaning you have to allow high energies and high velocities and stuff. So it's a little different from what we did when we just calculated the frequencies on the strings, like on a violin string. But if you solve such a thing, you're naturally going to get, just like we did with the classical string, you're naturally going to get discrete states that can exist for vibration where the waves basically will interfere constructively with each other, and other states where they don't interfere constructively basically won't be stable. So it is a natural way to get sort of a discrete spectrum of things. And if you imagine that the mass is what is determined by the energy of that state, if you solve for them, you basically can get a mass spectrum of particles. And what they found when they looked at this was that they got solutions on these strings that turned out to be mathematically very similar to descriptions of particles in quantum field theory. So, as odd as the idea may seem, they had an initial success with it. They had some problems. There were many solutions that were clearly corresponding to things we don't see. And they called these things ghost particles. And then they had one solution that clearly corresponds to something that they weren't expecting, but it turned out to be what you would expect if you had a quantum theory of gravity. So then they got very excited because they thought they might be on the track of solving the known issue is the mathematics and general relativity and that in quantum theory are basically incompatible. So the idea of expanding what has been so successful in describing the strong electromagnetic interactions to gravity is sort of a theorist's pipe dream, having been able to do it. So this, all of a sudden, they had a framework which naturally incorporated gravity. And because these objects now have an extent instead of point-like, they solve the problems that you get when you have interactions go to zero distance, which tends to give you infinities and things, because if you have one over r squared, when distance goes to zero, it floats up. So lots of math isn't very well behaved when you go to extreme limits like that. So string theory sort of solved some of those problems. But then the biggest issue, or one of the big issues that came up with string theory, were these many non-physical solutions. And what they found was that these solutions were there if you had 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 dimensions in space. But if you had 10 dimensions of states in the equations, all these non-physical solutions would basically sort of magically disappear in terms of the mathematics. So the mathematics becomes really well behaved at the cost of these additional six dimensions of space. So that's a problem, except that it had actually been, or in principle, had been solved many years earlier. So there was a guy named Calusa after 1919, when Einstein came up with his geometrical interpretation of gravity. So he has three dimensions of space and time, and you basically look at it as a fabric, and that fabric is flat or Cartesian, if you want to picture it that way, if you have no energy or matter in the space. But if you have mass, then the idea is it literally distorts the space. And it is that which conveys the gravitational force in Einstein's theory of general relativity. So Calusa looked at the similarities of relativity and electromagnetism, and he found that if he extended the theory to five dimensions, he could actually unify general relativity and electromagnetism in sort of one framework, which is pretty amazing. But then you have a problem, which is we don't have five dimensions, right? We live in three. So he found the same thing is true in string theory. So the whole way of trying to get rid of these dimensions is a bit, it's a bit like sweeping it under the rug. Because if you say that we live in three dimensions plus time, and you look at it from a scientific point of view, all you can really say is that we perceive three dimensions in time. But that doesn't mean that you might not have other dimensions. You just have to understand why that you don't see them. And so mathematically, you can make those dimensions go away by effectively, by hypothesizing that they exist at every point in space, but somehow the structure of them is curled up to a level that you can't see it. And so it sounds a bit crazy, but an example would be if you have a two-dimensional sheet of paper, you clearly have two dimensions. If I roll it up so that it's a tube, then it looks like it's in three dimensions. But if I now walk very, very far away, you'll see this is a one-dimensional object. So you can have dimensions effectively disappear if you're on much larger scales than the scale of the curvature, if you want to think about it. So this got people very excited, and you'll see a very nice TED talk by Brian Greene on Wednesday where he'll basically give you the string theorist religion. And the string theorist religion is, okay, what we have to do is make those six dimensions we don't see go away. And there are many different ways to do that geometrically. And it turns out that the way in which you do it determines the particle spectrum, the forces, and the constants of nature that you see in that vacuum, in that space. And the thing is, if you look at our universe, we appear to be finely tuned. The reading that I asked you to do this week, there's an article by a guy named Victor Singer, and he looks at the degree at which our universe is finely tuned to the point of view of physical constants. And so what do I really mean by that? If gravity were particularly weaker, you might not be able to form stars. If the strong nuclear force or the weak nuclear force were different, you might not be able, the stars would change, and you wouldn't form heavy elements, which would form life as we know it. If the dark energy, which we happen to have in our universe, happened to be a lot bigger, the universe would have expanded so fast you would never have formed stars. If it happened to be a lot smaller, the universe would have gone into existence and then collapsed immediately into nothing. So it turns out that you can examine basically many of the constants of nature and find that if you tweak them a little bit, we wouldn't be here. So many people look at this and say, okay, we're very finely tuned. So the problem with that is that scientists abhor that kind of thing. You don't want to have any sort of scientific theory that really depends on it being a special case. You want anything that you see as a special case to sort of naturally evolve out of the theory. So within string theory, you now have this idea that you twist up these extra dimensions, and you can imagine that different configurations geometrically will basically require, will have different amounts of energy effectively stored in the space itself. So in this theory, as well as in general relativity, basically the curvature of the space you can think of as a way of storing energy in that space, potential energy in the space. So you could imagine at this stage, if you have a vacuum of space itself having this potential energy, if there were a magical, if there were a particular solution that clearly minimized the energy of the vacuum relative to anything else, then if you could find that and calculate it, and then look at the constants in that, and those constants turned out to be those of our universe, you would then understand why you would at a very fundamental level understand why our universe is the way that it is, in spite of the fact that it seems opportune. So this is the string theorist religion, and that's what they're sort of seeking for many, many years, and many still are. Okay. The problem is that there isn't just one solution. There's approximately 10 to the 500 solutions, because there are lots of different ways that you can twist up these dimensions to make them go away. And you say, well, that shouldn't bother you, because maybe you have one that is ultimately the least energy and the most stable. But the problem is, if you look at how the energy of the vacuum varies as a function of all the parameters that you can vary in terms of how things are all twisted up, so, you know, how many times they loop around, how tight is it twisted, all of these things would correspond to different parameters of the, physicists would call it the phase space that you're using in the problem. If you look at how the energy of the vacuum changes as you change the characteristics of the way this thing is twisted, it's all twisted together, you can't avoid the fact that you will have some configurations that are more stable than others. So if this is sort of a measure of the energy space, and this is a measure of how I twist it to get some parameter that I use to change the twisting, you'll find a minimum in the energy, and if I have the parameter over here, it's going to have more energy in the vacuum. But the problem is, you'll have many minima in such a complicated space. And if the vacuum space, if you happen to twist it so that you land in one of these minima, then in principle, that's the vacuum you've got. And
sorry.
That's okay, thanks. So here's sort of a picture of what I'm trying to talk about. There are many different parameters that you would need if you're going to describe how six dimensions are twisted together or twisted up and disappear, and you have a lot of freedom in how you do it. But if we simplify that and only imagine the variation in a couple of the parameters, and energy corresponds to this axis, then you have many regions where you can have minima and energy. In fact, about 10 to the 500 different possibilities. And in principle, the vacuum, if you created it, twisted in that way, would be stable, because if I vary one of these parameters a little bit, I'll go up in energy, so it's not going to naturally work very well. So it's a little bit like if I have a ball on a hill, it's going to roll down and it'll settle here at the bottom. And so you can sort of picture that being what you would have here. You might change the parameter such that you end up somewhere over here, but basically that's not stable. So the parameter is then going to relax into something down there. But once you're in one of these valleys, then you would have to put energy into the system in order to get it out of that valley, which is really hard to do. But there is something that can happen naturally, and that is something known as quantum tunneling, which is you can take our ball example and you can imagine having two different valleys, but if we're talking about small things, quantum mechanics is very important, and you don't have just a particular particle. You have a wave function, that is, you have a probability of actually penetrating through a region which is classical to it. So this ball can never naturally just roll up here by itself and roll down over into that room. But quantum mechanically, if you look at the wave function of the wave function itself might penetrate over here. And if you recall our description of the wave function of things, that corresponds, the square of the wave function corresponds to the probability of actually finding the object in that spot. So it turns out that in quantum mechanical calculations, you can have a non-zero probability of finding something which would never get there classically. And it's known as quantum tunneling, and this isn't anything speculative in terms of all the kinds of crazy stuff we've talked about in this class. This is a very well understood process. This comes out of quantum mechanics, and we have many, many, many examples in the laboratory of things that actually do quantum tunneling. It's a standard technique that's used in all the devices that we use to make our solid-state electronics work. So it's a pretty well understood thing. So in principle, you can have a vacuum that settles down in one of these stable regions of space that could effectively quantum tunnel over here. And maybe a way to think about that is if you think about how the space is all twisted up, and I think I have a picture to... Where did I put it? Oh, I thought I put a picture in. Well, you can't see it, but these pictures are all a little bit different in terms of how things are settled. So if you imagine that this space has slightly different twisting from that space, which has slightly different twisting from that space, and has slightly different twisting from that space, one of the things that happens in quantum mechanics is recall that we don't have perfect certainty of what the numbers are. So if I have, for example, a parameter that corresponds to this twisting, our knowledge of that parameter is not perfectly known. In fact, it might vary a little bit, and those are known as quantum fluctuations. And you could imagine having a quantum fluctuation such that space of this nature effectively tunnels over and changes its twisting and becomes, and sort of maybe it makes it over here and then relaxes into that state. So you can have ways in which the twisting can change a little bit, and when it does, it can find itself in a different room. And so this is a way of having a vacuum in a particular situation that can actually, at a point, can change to a different type of vacuum. So you can imagine having an inflating space which is driven by the fact that you have a large potential energy in the vacuum space that you might picture comes from this extra, this weird twisting of the extra dimensions. And it could quantum tunnel into a space where that potential energy is reduced, which will actually reduce the term that causes the inflation. So this is a way of picturing, in fact, the Big Bang happening in inflating space, is you can have the space, but at a point the vacuum actually changes until the characteristics of the space that we see here, and we basically the inflation slows down to just sort of the standard expansion that we see now. So that's a little bit the idea. So if you have that kind of mechanism happening, then you might have a particular type of space that corresponds to a certain type of twisting that has a large potential energy in the vacuum, and you might have inflating space, and then at a point you might get a quantum fluctuation may change the way this is twisted and give you a different potential energy in the vacuum. You literally change the structure of the vacuum there. And then it could be, very often that may correspond to space that might collapse actually, so it may disappear very quickly. But once in a while it may correspond to expanding space that has different physical characteristics from the space that spawned it. And then within that, as it expands, you may have another one, etc. So with this crazy picture in string theory, you effectively could have inflation, and within the inflation, you would have bubbles of space that may pop out from these quantum fluctuations of the way that extra dimensions are twisted together, and each of these regions will have different physical characteristics. They may be expanding at different rates, they may have different constants of nature, etc. And because all of this is sort of born in this parameter space of minima, and you would sort of expect to populate the whole thing, which means no matter how finely tuned or bizarre any universe that is stable for any length of time in this picture may seem, you would expect to find universes that populate that part of phase space. And this is what's known as the cosmic landscape. And this particular concept, you can actually make an argument that that you have inflation always, and universes are sort of popping out all over the place. This is known as the bubble multiverse. Okay, so let me stop for a second. How are you doing? I mean, talk a little bit about this. All right, so this directly answers, if you wish, why our universe is finely tuned. All possibilities exist, including things that would seem finely tuned. We happen to find ourselves in a universe that has the characteristics we see. Of course, we can only evolve to see ourselves in the universe where we could exist. So even though it's finely tuned, since you populate all possibilities. So in a sense, out of this theory, it's very natural that a universe like this might exist. At the price of this universe is not unique at all. It's about as unique as you can imagine in terms of we have all possibilities. So certainly this is not it's fairly contentious in some level. This is now becoming the paradigm, but you have very well-known theorists who will say, this is really not very different from God of the Gaps. Like God of the Gaps is, whatever I can't explain, I invoke God. Okay. So how is this different? I mean, in a sense, you're saying, I have concocted a theory where anything that can happen does happen. It's almost as much of a showstopper as God of the Gaps in terms of the discussion, right? It's about as provable. Right? It's not... You can argue over, is this even science? Because it's not falsifiable. So proponents will tell you it is falsifiable in the sense that although we seem to be in a finely tuned universe, if you look at the great phase space of possibilities of different parameter sets in this cosmic landscape that we expect to see, you could, in principle, make a probability distribution for how all of those parameters will vary. In other words, if we had infinite computing power and infinite time, we could actually look at all 10 to the 500 possibilities and look at the probability distribution for each set of parameters. And from that, you could, in principle, go to every of the 10 to the 500 universes and assign a probability for a universe of that sort to exist. And if you weren't able to do that, and you found that our universe was very improbable, then it's sort of falsifying. You're basically saying this picture can't be right. If you were able to make such a parameter set, even though we seem finely tuned, somehow it shouldn't be in a completely improbable universe under such a theory. Any thoughts? In practice, I'm not so sure how practical that is. Well, okay, I am sure it's impractical. I should rephrase that. In principle, there is a certain degree of potential falsifiability of this, and you could argue that it's science. But short of learning something new about this, we can never, because these regions of space are causally disconnected. We can't step outside and see these other universes. It is not practical to imagine you can really do these probability spaces, although people are working on trying to do that. On the other hand, you know, string theory itself is, 50 years old, and we've learned an awful lot. Our studies of cosmic microwave background, we just saw the structure in cosmic microwave background in 1992, and now we're studying more details of it, and we've had some surprises happen. So I don't know where we're going to go, but at least right now, we're causally disconnected from these spaces. You can't go out and see them. You have this idea of the possible cosmic landscape, which is really hard. So if you want to believe in it, you believe in it, I guess. It's a little bit, but it is a bit different from just straight up religion in the sense that there's a huge amount of experimental evidence that actually pointing toward aspects of this picture. We have pretty strong evidence that the Big Bang happened, and we have growing evidence that inflation happened. And I'm about to talk about this new result that has come out recently because it has implications about whether you believe in inflation or not. We understand quantum fluctuations and quantum mechanics, and so this picture basically is inferred from all of those things which are scientifically supported. So it is a little bit different. Okay. Yes.
So the scientists who are making that claim, they're not making an attempt to sort of like a chosenness argument, right? That like our universe, bubbles, right? That our universe is somehow like more probable because.
Well, they. Right. I think that, so part one of the claim is that you would expect all minima to be populated at some level. So no matter how bizarre the set of parameters are, you might expect to find an example. So in that sense, there's nothing, even if we found ourselves to be really strange, set of, unusual set of parameters, in principle it should exist somewhere and we would just find ourselves in that universe. That, I think people would feel warmer and fuzzier about it if in fact we found that in looking at the whole set of parameters that something as finely tuned the way we are isn't that unusual, I guess. If it truly is only one of the 10 to the 500 out there that is like, is could, where we could exist, that would truly be interesting. That would give us, that would almost take us to the other extreme of the string theory of religion, which is there is a best answer, but then the problem is why are you driven to that answer? And in the cosmic landscape, all possibilities happen. And you may change from place to place, but no. So, I mean, it is, I think, in terms of the theory of everything, it sort of says you're not going to find the ultimate theory of everything explained by the universe in the sense that you can have all sorts of different. Alright, so the Earth is not the center of the universe. The Sun is not the center of the universe. Our galaxy is not the center of the universe. Our Sun isn't special, it's just a star. Our galaxy isn't special, there are hundreds of millions of them. And now we're finding even our universe maybe isn't special, sort of us being in it. Okay? So this is sort of the Copernican revolution on the terrible march. So, if you thought that was bad, Max Tegmark has cooked up one better. He calls it the mathematical universe hypothesis. So in the mathematical universe hypothesis, Max says, all right, so we have to believe in a couple of things for this theory to work. One is what he calls the external reality hypothesis. So you make the claim that there exists a reality that is completely independent of us humans. I mean, most scientists I know sort of intuitively probably would believe that, but we did an essay about whether mathematics was discovered or created, right? So this harkens back to that a little bit. So first of all, let us assume for a moment that there exists an external reality which is completely independent of us humans. So remember, we've also, in quantum mechanics, in the Copenhagen version, some extreme believers in the Copenhagen version basically say it is the interaction of the observer themselves, because we have to gain knowledge of the wave function before it collapses. So it isn't universally accepted that this is true, but I think it's not too hard to swallow it for most of us. So if you believe this, then the ultimate goal of theoretical physics is to literally come up with a framework through which we can understand this external reality. And so that's sort of what we call the theory of everything. And we've talked about sort of the string theorists feeling that maybe they're on to that. Okay, so if we have a theory of everything, so Max is now, if you recall, early on we looked at Max Tegmark's multiverse taxonomy, and he had type 1, type 2, type 3, and type 4 multiverses. Type 1 was simply where you have inflation making the universe very big relative to our observable universe, and you have a lot of causally disconnected regions of space, an infinite number of them. And that's his type 1 multiverse. Type 2 would be the bubble multiverse that we've been talking about. Type 3 is the quantum mechanical many worlds multiverse that we've talked about. And type 4 is then this one. In Max's mind, the taxonomy makes sense because he's going to greater and greater degrees of mathematical abstraction. And so now this is the ultimate in the mathematical abstraction. So he's stepping back quite a ways to look at this. So he says, there is an external reality. If there exists a theory of everything, the theory of everything has to be completely unambiguous if it's truly going to describe reality. If it's completely unambiguous, you have no room for human-generated ambiguities, like language. Right. So Max argues there's only one way that we could imagine describing such a thing, and that would be mathematics, because mathematics is unambiguous. Every mathematical system that we have has very particular rules, and they're unambiguous. So I guess he belongs to the camp that mathematics is discovered, not invented. But even to the extent that it's invented, it is invented to be unambiguous. So if you have a theory of everything, it has to be unambiguous, and because it's a theory of everything, basically it has to contain within it a description of every part of reality. And a way that he says that is you have to be able to have what's known as an isomorphic mapping between reality and this mathematical structure, whatever it is. And in mathematics, what you mean when you say you have an isomorphic mapping, if I have some mathematical theory here and some mathematical theory here, if I have a one-to-one mapping of each piece of this one to each piece of that one, then you actually, that's a mathematical way of saying that these two things are the same thing. So what Max argues is that if you have a theory of everything that really describes that this external reality, that by virtue of what it is, it has to have this one-to-one map with the external reality, which he then goes on to say, because of that, that mathematical structure is the reality. In the same way that in mathematics we say if this one is isomorphic to that one, they're basically equivalent. So he then takes a big step and he argues that if you have such a mathematical structure that you can take the step that the external reality really is equivalent to that mathematical structure. And this is what he calls the mathematical universe hypothesis. So when I first ran across this, I was wondering what he was smoking up at MIT. And then the more I read, I was beginning to get the flavor of it. This is a pretty strange idea, but to a mathematician, it actually sort of makes sense because you're used to defining very clearly what you mean by an equivalence, and it is this sort of one-to-one mapping. So, I admit this is a pretty bizarre step, but it actually gets a little bit worse because if you argue that our external reality is basically equivalent to a mathematical structure that is self-consistent and independent, irreducible, and unambiguous, okay, then you have to ask why that structure and not some other. Because in mathematics, you can invent all sorts of different, complete, self-consistent, irreducible mathematical theories. So what's special about the one which we're calling the theory of everything, other than the fact that it seems to be a theory of everything? So with that, he then argues that perhaps there is nothing special about that particular mathematical structure, and that any mathematical structure which exhibits all of these characteristics would correspond to an external reality. So, not only is Earth not the center of the universe, orbiting the Sun not the center of the universe, our galaxy not being special, our universe not being special, we live in a bubble multiverse. What he's saying is even the external reality that describes this entire bubble multiverse might be one of an infinite number of possibilities, basically because of this weird equivalence between mathematics and reality. So that, I cannot imagine being any more extreme in terms of the Copernican revolution. So to summarize, what he really says is, what he's saying with this weird idea is that if you believe in an external reality independent of humans and that there exists a theory of everything, that theory of everything must be well defined and ambiguous. It must be mathematics, it must be self-contained, and it must have parts that correspond to every aspect of reality. And when you do that, then what you're saying is that the reality is that mathematical theory. What's special about that theory, since we know there are different mathematical theories that can exhibit all of this stuff? So that one's really out there. Any thoughts, questions? Projector problems, and it'll be a little bit cooler.